Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. I have had the pleasure of talking to some of the leading authors, artists, activists, and change makers of our time on this podcast. And I want to personally thank you for subscribing, listening, and sharing 100 plus episodes over 100,000 times. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy. And I look forward to more conversations with those important voices that will bring clarity to the situation we find ourselves in as we move toward November of 2024. If you appreciate these conversations and my cultural and political commentary, please subscribe to this podcast, In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, on your favorite platform, and to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. I'd really appreciate the help. Thank you.
You know, our country is currently spending $1 trillion a year on the doctor, on hospitals and drugs, but it only has 10% to do with your health outcomes. 10%. I think you could argue we're not spending the money very wisely.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, and you are listening to and or watching my podcast, In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, which is wherever podcasts can be found, also on YouTube, also Facebook Live event, and all these other things. I just finished reading a book that I enjoyed very much. We're going to talk about today because we've got the author with us. But let me introduce Reverend Scott Morris, MD, who is a Methodist pastor as well as a medical doctor. Deeply involved in, I guess, what you would call social work, as well as in medical practice. And he's written a book, which we will talk about today at some length. And the title is just one word, care. And then the subtitle is, which I will read because I mess subtitles up, How People of Faith Can Respond to Our Broken Health System. And my friend Jim Wallace, that I go way back with, wrote the foreword, and in the foreword brought up a very interesting thing, which sort of ties the book to the author in an odd way. And that is that John Wesley, the evangelist, I guess you could call him that, and church founder, and the founder of the Methodist Church, really, was also a medical doctor, practiced medicine. So we have a doctor who practices medicine who's started a center for healthcare for folks that don't normally find that, has written a book with a lot of individual stories to, I guess, illustrate the need for what you do, as well as telling the story of how people are sharing their Christian faith through caring for others in a very practical way. So I think that's enough of a setup. Scott, welcome. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for the book. Was it published in 2022? I know Erdman's published it. I forget the pub date itself.
Yeah, it came out in November, just a couple months ago.
Yeah, because in just reading it, I don't know when you actually finished the work, as in turned the manuscript in, but it did get into the COVID era. When was the book actually written and completed?
You know how this works. It was probably in January of 2022. So it came out pretty fast. But
we had been through a lot. You know, the COVID era seems to have been around forever now. So I actually get confused on was that our COVID year staying at home? When was that? Then the year after, and it's gone by long enough so that I know that the book was impacted by that.
Right. So COVID started in March of 21.
Right. Okay. So by the time this book came out, you had had enough time to kind of think about how COVID had impacted that. Speaking of which, let me just talk about one other thing and then we'll get into it. Church Health is an organization which you founded also in Memphis, which is, would you call it a clinic? Would you call it how would you describe it?
I mean, we definitely have a clinic. We operate out of a building that used to be a Sears distribution center, but it's, we offer medical care, dental care, eye care. We really engage the broader faith community over doing this type of work. So, you know, but our clinic is at a center of probably most of these stories that I write about. And
Although some of the stories involve people and you talk about their backstory when they were in another country, for instance,
right,
giving medical care in a missionary type effort or an NGO, and then how they brought that back with them. How many people are at Church Health right now in terms of any given day, both volunteer or paid? Who all works there?
So we have 250 employees that are on the staff. And then in terms of patients, there are 80,000 people in Memphis who depend on us for their healthcare. And then we have 1,000 physicians who volunteer with us. So that's not a made up number. So,
and how far away do some of those 1,000 physicians come from?
They're all in Memphis.
Because I know Memphis is a fair sized city, but to pull 1,000 MDs in to do anything from one area is pretty remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, there are very few doctors in Memphis who would not volunteer to take care of our patients if we asked them to. But, it took 35 years to build up that network, which is really impressive about the way things work in Memphis.
How many, I'm sorry to get so detailed, but I'm so fascinated and frankly gobsmacked by the scale, which I had not in any way envisioned in terms of just the size of the thing, to the point where I've almost lost my train of thought. I'm just trying to get my head around it. Okay, so you're offering care to people and some of this is on your own premises. Would this involve surgical procedures where you're at various hospitals in the area that maybe have more sophisticated and bigger scale of equipment?
Yeah, so I'm a family practitioner, so I'm not a surgeon, but
right.
Of those 1,000 doctors, they are, some of them are super specialists, but there's not a problem somebody could have from the cradle to the grave we can't take care of. So we have an arrangement with our hospitals in Memphis that as long as the physician is donating his or her time, then we can admit patients, and that patient's never going to receive a bill.
What about from the hospital itself where the procedure's done?
Not going to receive a bill from the hospital. There's not a problem somebody could have from the cradle to the grave we can't take care of. It's a small miracle, but we've been
doing it. Let me put it this way. Why does anybody in Memphis go to anyone except you guys? I mean, you're on such a big scale. You must be one of the largest medical practices in the state, let alone the city.
Well, I mean, our focus is on the people who work to make our lives comfortable. They cook your food, take care of your children, wash your clothes, will one day dig your grave. But they're working in low-wage jobs who don't have health insurance. So if you have health insurance, good for you. You don't need us. So that's why not just anybody comes.
What do you think of the percentage of the population? How many folks live in the Memphis area now, the greater?
Roughly 1 million.
Okay, so out of that 1 million, let's just say, roughly speaking, how many would you think would be your client base in terms of no insurance?
Right. So there's about 150,000 people in the Memphis area that are uninsured, and about 80,000 of them depend on Church Health for their health care. So, we take care of about half of the folks who are uninsured, but there's still a lot more. Sadly, that's true across America. And that's a big part of what this book is about, is that there are 26 million uninsured Americans. What happens when they get sick? Who's going to take care of them?
And there's a lot of places I want to go with this, but let me just drill down a little more on Church Health, because this is an amazing program. First of all, do you find that people in other cities and other communities in the country, has anybody tried to emulate what you're doing or been inspired by it and said, gee, we could do this in our town?
Yes. So the book talks a lot about this. We created something called ECHO, which stands for Empowering Church Health Opportunities.
Yeah.
Church Health has helped open about 90 clinics around the country, literally all over the place. But there are 1,400 free and charitable clinics, mostly sponsored by faith communities, doing this work. And, the mainstream media has really never picked up on this. We struggle mightily to try to tell the story. But I didn't realize that you were friends with Jim Wallis, but you probably know the book he wrote a few years ago called God's Politics, How the Right Doesn't Get It and the Left Doesn't Care.
Sure.
That has absolutely been our experience about trying to tell this story. It's just, you know, once you bring faith into the mix here, people don't want to hear it.
I had an interesting experience, and this is a little bit off the chart, but I'll share it with you. The other day, I met a woman at a post-Christmas party down the street where my wife and I were invited to a neighbor's house, and she was from China, and she's someone on the staff of a very swanky local boarding school that's been around since 16-something, you know, one of those old New England institutions.
Right.
And when I saw she was Chinese, we got into discussion, and she was telling me that she's from Beijing originally, in Shanghai, and how she got to the States. And I said, well, my mother was born in China and lived there till she was 7. And she jumped right in and said, your mother must have been the daughter of missionaries, given that she was, you know, doing the math of when that was. I said, my mom died when she was 98 and she was in China. And then she said something that was very unexpected in this context of a kind of a social gathering of people. She said, well, you know, the Communist Party, of course, has lied about the missionary efforts in China. But there would not be any hospitals or clinics in China at all if they hadn't been started by the missionaries in the pre-communist era. Now, we had never met before. This is literally probably the third exchange we had in a five minutes standing over a drink, shouting in a loud room. And it was so unexpected that we spent the rest of the night talking. And she described herself. She said, well, you know, I'm a very secular person. I would describe myself as an atheist, but coming from the background I come from in China, I have come to realize that if it had not been for the social involvement of the Christians, both in China and around the world, we would be looking at a very different situation. So then we got into a whole discussion about colonialism and all sorts of things, but it began with her recognition of a very sort of Wesleyan Methodist idea that the gospel had meant something positive in this context, which is forgotten. Which then comes to your question of, you know, why does the secular part of our culture or the left or more progressive people not pick up on what you're doing? And then on the other hand, the media also, and it's probably, I'm going to take a wild guess, and that is it doesn't suit anybody's simplistic agenda of the roles we now have in this culture, especially in the post-Trump era, when evangelicals have basically managed to give themselves a reputation which is about as far away from what you're doing as one could imagine. And I don't know if that little riff sparks anything in you, but I'd sure like to hear what you think.
Well, look, the fact of the matter is it's true on both sides of this. You know, Descartes, that recapitulates Plato, convinces us all that you can take a human being and separate us into a body and a spirit. And we put the body on one side and say it's the purview of science and medicine. We put the spirit on the other, say it's okay for people of faith to mess around with our spirits, but heaven forbid it cross this line and actually care about our bodies. So the fact of the matter is both from the majority of people of faith do not want to have anything to do with issues of the body if there's not a spiritual link to that. You know, evangelical Christians only care about healthcare if it can lead to you loving Jesus. And then the other side of that is the moment you talk about a spiritual component to life, most people in the medical world don't want to have anything to do with it. But an example in line with what you were just saying, you know, I don't think most Christians think about how did it happen that from the end of the writing of the New Testament, that there's only a handful of Christians, right? But by the fourth century, when Constantine becomes emperor, he sees the writing on the wall to the point where he converts the entire nation to Christianity. So how did that happen? How did there get to be so many Christians? Now, most preachers will tell you it had to be because of good preaching, but good preaching had nothing to do with it. In the second and third century, there were plagues all over the Roman world. And when people got sick, it was only the Christians who were willing to take care of them. Mm. And when they got better, they asked the question, who is your God that I might worship him? That's what grew the church.
Yeah, you make that point in the book, and Jim actually highlights that in his introduction to the book as well, that he learned something from your book. Jim says, this is Jim Wallace. He did not know that until he read you. You know, there's an interesting parallel, because I'm a writer and an artist and filmmaker, and I have talked for years about the fact that the same thing applies to the arts. And that is one of the things that is so forgotten within the Christian community is very similar to what you're saying. And that is that, you know, Bach and Rembrandt were not trying to convert people when they were painting or sculpting or doing whatever they did. A whole raft of artists who were believers, whether evangelical or otherwise. But the fact of the matter is they thought that their testimony was to be good at what they were doing. And they actually shaped a whole culture. Whereas these days, you know, often the same thing is true. You meet a young person who's trying to be a guitarist or a pianist, and if they come from a certain type of pietistic evangelical background, the question is always, well, how are you going to serve the Lord with that? Or, okay, so you're doing this music, you mean you're doing, quote, Christian music with a message. It's never the intrinsic worth of art itself as a gift from the Creator that doesn't need any justification, in the same way that you don't, I'm sure, tell people, look, you know, we're going to help you in the clinic as long as you listen to the gospel message and respond in some way, or, you know, come to church with us. Can you unpack some of that pietistic Christian belief system, which is so different than what was, you know, John Wesley was preaching? I think it's a tremendous subject. And I think you're in a, I know this is not specifically about your book, but I also think it is. Yeah.
Well, look, I'm not an evangelical Christian, but I am a United Methodist minister and Wesleyan to the core.
Right.
But, you know, in order to really understand about health and how these things are connected, our view of health is that being healthy is not about the absence of disease. You know, the World Health Organization would agree with that. Mm-hmm. You know, who cares if you live 2 years longer if it means 2 years longer in a nursing home? You know, life for life's sake can't possibly be the point. Breathing in, breathing out, none of us are signing up for that. Yeah. So what we think being healthy is about, and I think this is connecting with the arts here, is that it's ultimately about three things: having more joy in your life, having more love in your life, and being driven closer to things greater than we are. Now, we would call that God. You don't have to call that God. You can be an atheist and still realize there are things greater than we are. But if this is what it takes to be healthy, more joy, more love, being driven closer to God or things greater than we are, it doesn't have a lot to do with the doctor, which led us to create something we call the model for healthy living. So what we would argue, there are seven things in life that are equally important to life that must be in balance in order to be healthy. So one of them is medical care, but only one. You know, our current country is currently spending $1 trillion a year on the doctor, on hospitals and drugs, but it only has 10% to do with your health outcomes. 10%. I think you could argue we're not spending the money very wisely. But the other things are nutrition. Our bodies are meant to use food as medicine. Movement, our bodies were made to move. Emotions, family and friends, work. We define work as those things that bring meaning to your life. And lastly, your faith life. We think your faith life is as important as anything the doctor might do. So those seven things must be in balance if you're going to be healthy. And that drives all of the work we do. It drives our view of how you help people stay healthy. And it also would include things like the arts. You know, that's from our work. You know, poor people deserve art. But most people consider that to be just an extraneous thing, which is it's anything but that.
Yeah, let me say who I'm talking to here for people who might have just joined us. This podcast is In Conversation with Frank Schaefer. Today, my guest is Reverend Scott Morris, who is a medical doctor, the founder of Church Health. I'm going to have to describe it as an enormous health operation in Memphis. You know, this is not a footnote to American healthcare. This is a huge deal. And then has written this book, which I like very much, called Care. Let me get back to the book for a minute and just ask you, in writing that book, there's sort of two messages in the book, as I understand it. One is through telling the stories you tell about the people who reached out to others in compassion, plus also an analysis of the, I guess you could call it, the moral bankruptcy of the American healthcare system, which is not doing what you're trying to do through church health. Do you hope that the book itself will be another thing that you can use to bring more attention to the entire project of your life and your work? And the second question, I guess, which is very much to do with that, is how do you see the balance and how do you spend your time between your work as an ordained minister and your work running this incredible sort of off the wall, huge operation of healthcare for over 100,000 people who don't have insurance? How do those two aspects of your own life balance out? Just on a very personal note, I'm curious.
I mean, my own life, I spend most of my time playing doctor. That the all morning before coming on to talk with you, I've been seeing patients.
Right.
But I think of myself as a pastor who acquired a particular skill. And the mission of Church Health is actually not to solve the great social problems in America. We actually right. don't know how to do that.
Right.
We're not trying to do that. Mm. What we're trying to do is help people of faith. And I don't care whether you're Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Hindu. I don't care. We are all called, I believe, to do the same type of work of caring for our bodies and our spirits and caring for the poor who are sick. But how do you do that? What does that look like in today's world? So we focus efforts on two areas. One, to help the medical community understand that there is a spiritual dimension to life and that just giving pills to people is not going to make us healthier. In fact, oftentimes just the opposite. You know, the other side of this, though, is that our faith community doesn't understand the importance of healthcare in our world. If we just look at it from a Christian perspective, you know, the call to discipleship, you want to follow Jesus. You're expected to do three things: to preach, to teach, and to heal. We do not get to take a pass on the healing part. You know, a third of the New Testament has to do with healing the sick. It's literally on every page. So if you want to follow Jesus, you got to figure out how you're going to be engaged in a healing ministry.
Well,
if you're
not
doing that, you're ignoring a third of the gospel.
In your book, you have the quip at one point where you're saying, you know, do you want to go before God and have him say, when it comes to healing and caring, do you think I was kidding about that?
Exactly.
Which is the way you put it in the book. And I love that.
I'll give you an example of how we don't take that seriously. In the midst of the obesity epidemic in America, clergy are 20% heavier than the rest of the population. So you can't, in our churches, we have blessed the sin of gluttony for the sake of fellowship. You can't have a healthy church if you don't have healthy leaders. But we struggle mightily to get clergy to take this stuff seriously. But anyway, this is what our mission is all about. And the point of the book is to try to help churches understand, and again, not just Christian churches, but all faith communities. And then the other side of it is to get the medical world to realize that engaging the spiritual dimension to life is what actually leads to people being healthier.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. If you appreciate my cultural and political commentary, please do me a favor and subscribe to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. You can subscribe for free, or you can kick in a couple of dollars a month and help me out and help me keep this going if you're able. Either way, I'm incredibly grateful for your support and most of all for your participation. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy as we move toward November of 2024. And every subscription helps create, build, sustain, and put voice to this movement for truth. Thank you so much. Yeah, something I'd like to ask you about related to the book is Do you feel that the book is something that could break through in the medical community itself? Or do you feel this is more what I would say to the lay community, as in giving them a better vision of what medical care or care itself? I like the title, just care. It's not just medical care. The care of the whole person could be. In the best of all worlds, you know, hopefully both would be reading that. But do you find, for instance, that with the doctors you're working with and others, are some of these folks going to read this book or are reading it? And the same with, you know, other people who are interested. You said, you know, you were very clear saying, I'm not an evangelical. Erdmann's is not particularly an evangelical publisher. I guess you would call it not evangelical, but a religious publisher, but also with social philosophy and all these other things. Who do you find might be the reader, and how do you reach that vast evangelical community that might be open to the idea of following Jesus at some point? And I'm being a little bit sarcastic, but that's sort of where it's at. Is the book a kind of a missionary effort to that community as well? Or are you just talking to other Methodists?
I hope I'm not talking to other Methodists. I think it is a missionary endeavor. I am trying to get people who take their faith seriously to recognize that this is a way that you can live into your being faithful. So, I mean, look, evangelicals struggle mightily, I think, even though they don't talk about it, with the issue of faith. What happens when they are uncertain, when they have doubt? That seems to be a concept that they run away from at every turn. But if you are engaged in a healing ministry, you do the work that happens at Church Health every day and in other clinics around the country. If you're actually doing this work day in and day out, in those moments when you have doubt and you are uncertain, you can actually be drawn closer to God by the fact of the matter is that in being engaged in a healing ministry makes people's lives better. Hmm. And you work your way through this until your faith is stronger, you know, but a lot of Christians just shy away from that. You know, you probably know that, you know, Paul Tillich said that, you know, faith without doubt renders your faith idolatrous. But, you know, many, many Christians just can't embrace that. Yes, my book is a missionary endeavor on both sides, both for physicians, but also for people of faith.
Yeah. You brought up Paul Tillich. I was thinking also about Albert Schweitzer and his ideas. You know, there's I don't want to get too into the weeds, as the British would say here. But since you've mentioned Tillich and I just threw Schweitzer's name out, when you look at the more contemporary people, say in the last couple hundred years, I mean, starting with John Wesley, not going all the way back into the New Testament era or the Byzantine era of the conversion by Constantine, how do you see the modern era in terms of other people who have tried to pull off what you're doing? To greater or lesser success? What are your roots? Who inspires and who has given you a little bit of a template for what you've done in Church Health and also what you're getting at in your book? And then beyond that, your own life. I mean, your thinking must have started somewhere. You didn't just pick up John Wesley's writing or read a sermon and start. Give me a little bit of the story of your own social consciousness, theology, whatever you want to call it.
Well, look, in terms of sort of theologians, if you will, people like Walter Rauschenbusch, I find greatly inspiring. That the mentor in my own life was William Sloan Coffin. You're somebody who might actually know who Coffin is.
I do indeed. In fact, I'm in a town where Coffin, one of his relatives, is someone who I knew, someone who descended from Coffin.
Really?
Yes. Well, honesty, and he was a very elderly gentleman, and I forget if it was a great-great-grandson or whatever. Here on the North Shore above Boston. So I'm totally clued in on this.
Coffin married my wife and I and inspired me at every turn. But my own personal story is I grew up in Atlanta. You know, growing up in Atlanta, I was always interested in the church. But for me, the thought of preaching 52 sermons a year sent shivers down my spine, still does. Yeah. I don't know how anybody could do that. But I read the Bible, realized that a third of the Bible has to do with healing the sick. But I looked around and there just wasn't much to it. All over this country, we built large hospitals that have church names on them. They do good work. But they have almost nothing to do with worshiping congregation. It seemed to me that there ought to be more to it than that. So I went to college. I went to seminary. I spend most of my time in seminary looking at what the church has historically done and came to realize there's a reason these hospitals have church names on them. We just forgot. And then trying to figure out how this plays out in my own life. But one day I'm in the chaplain's office at the Yale Medical School, and I looked on his desk and there's a little pamphlet that said how to start a church-based health clinic. And I go, that's it. That's what I want to do. Written by.
And when was that? Just give me an approximate date.
Oh my God. 1978. And then from that, I realized there's a lot of people who care about the link between faith and health. You may know Gordon Cosby and the Church of the Savior in Washington had developed a clinic under, you know, maybe the only living saint I know right now, Dr. Janelle Getchess. But from her, she inspired me to figure out how to do this. And so I didn't finish college. I finished seminary, medical school. I do a residency to be a family doctor. I'm ready to start my own church-based health clinic. I want to stay in the South. I don't want to go back to Atlanta. And then, not making this up, I read somewhere that Memphis is the poorest major city in America. And based on that, I said I was going to Memphis. At that point, I was 33 years old. I was too young, too dumb to realize that what I wanted to do had no chance to succeed. So I came to Memphis in 1986, just totally selling off an empty cart, knocking on doors to create something that would eventually be called Church Health. So we opened our doors September 1st, 1987. We saw 12 people the first day we were open. It's the fewest we've ever seen. And now there are 80,000 people who depend on us for their healthcare.
That's really just stunning. You mentioned that Sloan Coffin married you guys. When was that?
My wife and I both been married twice. So he married us in right around 2000. So So we've been married about a little over 20 years.
So. Yeah, so that's really something. I've never met anybody who he married before. That's quite a distinction. little footnote there. Moving on. When it comes to funding, which is a question people will ask, obviously, you know, this is part of the equation here. People aren't paying for the healthcare they're getting with you. How does that happen?
So we have a budget of $25 million a year, which we have to raise in the community. So I'm a professional beggar. I'm not above begging money for anybody. We have 250 employees that like to get paid every 2 weeks, but that's where most of the money goes. But when you do the math and you factor in all of the volunteer surgeries and services, you know, the value of what we do is about $300 million a year. But we have to find a way every year to raise $25 million. So what we don't do is depend on the government to do this work. This is, you know, an interesting thing. I don't know how large your audience is as evangelicals. You may have run them all off, but there are a number of health clinics around America that are actually run by evangelicals that are funded by the federal government,
right?
In what are called federally qualified health centers. So the church health perspective is we would never do that. You know, our mission is to engage people of faith to do this work. So from my perspective, the government cannot do the work of the church, and neither should we ask it to. So either we raise $25 million a year or we have to let the doors close. Because if we are funded primarily by the government, what does that make us? It makes us a federally funded clinic. And our mission completely is imploded. So We're never going down that path.
Yeah, because obviously the mission is this kind of public following of Jesus, which is not a federal program, and it's an expression of the faith of the whole person. So obviously it would be impossible to do that as a government operation. Yeah. It's a very different thing. That's completely logical to me. You know,
but and it turns people off so fast when yeah. they hear me say, we're not pursuing government funding. How can you sustain this?
Yeah.
You know, that is like asking, how can you sustain the church? You know, the government doesn't fund any church.
Right.
At least it shouldn't.
At least it shouldn't.
So either we can raise this money and live into what I believe God's called us to do, or we're not able to do this. But I mean, even with my book, I'm so grateful for your interviewing me here. But as I've tried to tell this story in the mainstream media, you know, I've done everything I know how to do to try to get the New York Times to let me write an op-ed about this work, about the 1,400 clinics that are out there caring for people. The moment they hear the word church, they just shut it down. You know, I can't even find the opportunity to tell the story. Because their assumption is that we're out here trying to make people convert to Jesus before we will provide them healthcare, which is could not be further from the truth.
Yeah, no, self-evidently, or they are ignorant about the Methodists as a group, or, you know, because if you knew a little bit more about Methodism and John Wesley, that would not be what you'd be thinking. In terms of that history, let me get back to something that I told you earlier that I was sort of gobsmacked by the scale of what you're doing. I'm going to get to this in a second, but I just want to mention to people who are listening to this or watching it that we are going to post links to Scott Morris, to his book, Care, how to get that book, and also in terms of church health. So if you're scratching your head saying, how do I get in touch? You know, I want to follow up. All of that will be wherever this is. We're going to have all those links that Scott will provide to us and to my producer, Ernie, who will make sure that it all goes up with this. Okay, let me get back to the 80,000 people you serve here who get their health care from you. You know, that is a stunning figure. I guess the way to flip this to see how clearly it is, you said there's about 100,000 who don't have insurance out of the 1 million. Is that correct?
150,000.
150,000. So of the 80,000 people you're serving, that is such a huge proportion of your city's uninsured that it seems to me that that number alone, which is stunning, is a passport to massive interest by the media, you know, the New York Times op-ed, Washington Post, whomever you would.
Hey, Frank, we're in Memphis. You know, Memphis doesn't exist for.
No, but you would think that Terry Gross and Fresh Air and folks would be beating your door down and wanting to talk to you about that, even if they weren't going to talk about the book.
Right.
Just what you have done here. Again, you open your doors. Give me the date again.
1987.
Okay, so the 12 people come in, and now it's 80,000 a year. That alone is a story that you would think every American would have heard about, in the same way that we all have heard. Everybody knows what you mean when you say Mayo Clinic. We've all heard of the Mayo Clinic. It's part of the fabric of our culture. Why doesn't everybody know about this? Why am I a fairly well-read person in my own little thing? And my friend Jim Wallace wrote this introduction for you. Why am I sitting here going, how on earth can this be happening? And I don't know all about it. And you know, you should be reading something about what you're doing every week somewhere. I mean, healthcare is all we've been discussing with Obamacare and everything else for the last 20 years. Healthcare is sort of the number one or number two or number three of things people are concerned by, they vote on. They get passionate about socialism, one single payer versus this. You know, how come what you're doing is not a big part of this discussion?
Yeah, so I think I appreciate you asking that question, but I think it's because we don't easily fit into a pigeonhole somewhere. Yeah. I do think from the mainstream media standpoint, they don't look underneath the hood when they realize we are a faith-based organization.
Yeah.
And then, you know, from the faith community standpoint, this issue of caring for the body just is not what attracts most faith communities. But it goes beyond that. You've made comment, you know, I am not in a made up screen here. This is a live shot of where we exist. And we are the anchor tenant of a building in Memphis that was once a Sears distribution center that in square footage is larger than the Empire State Building. That Sears quit publishing their catalog in 1992. And as a result, this building was completely abandoned. There are 3,200 windows. Every last one was broken. It was surrounded in barbed wire. It had gotten to be, why would gangs run anything else in the building? What more was there to say? But with us, along with an arts group, a number of other entities, we ultimately renovated this building. There are 48 entities that have signed long-term leases to be in the building. There are 265 apartments. Again, in square footage, it's larger than the Empire State Building. And it's amazing what $300 million can do to an abandoned building. This whole story is like an incredible story that has not been told either. And it all comes down to, you know, we are in Memphis. You know, we remain the poorest major city in America. And it's like, people don't want to hear this story. So it does get frustrating, but, we just keep doing this work. We're going to do it today and tomorrow. We're going to do it the day after that.
Well, listen, you know, this is crazy because it doesn't sound like a podcast professional thing to do, but that's not where we're at. But I'm talking to my producer, Ernie, who's listening in on this. We now have a new project, Ernie. We are going to find a way to help promote what's going on. And when I say promote, that's the wrong word. We're going to find a way to crack this story to the media. And we're going to find some filmmaker friends of ours who are going to show up with a crew do a documentary on you. Because seriously, this is insane. Well, I mean, I have a new little fire starting on, like, not on my watch. I mean, this is crazy that you're caring for the 80,000 people.
Accept my invitation to come to Memphis and let me show you around.
Thanks, by the way, to Kim Weiss, who for this connection. I don't know what that connection is. What's Kim Weiss, and why do we know through her about this?
She's helping to promote the book.
So is she the publicist at Erdmann's?
Yes. No, we actually reached out beyond Erdmann's, and she works for an organization called PR by the Book. And so she was literally just our assigned person. I've never actually met Kim in person. Yeah. But she's
Well, thank you, Kim, for getting us in touch with us. But in all seriousness, there's so many stories here within the story, you know, and one story is the lack of media attention and awareness of what you're doing is really important, because you're taking a completely different approach by not taking government funds. You know, you should be endeared to folks like the Hillsdale College crowd of the right, not right wing, but conservatives who eschew all government everything. That's, I'm sure, not where you're personally coming from in terms of government funding for what's appropriate.
I want to correct you there. We don't rely on government funding, but like during COVID, you know, we took the money to make sure we didn't have to lay anybody off. So
it's, I understand. Yeah. All right. And churches did too, by the way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just want to make sure. And then the other thing, there are 80,000 people who depend on church health. I don't necessarily see them every year. So it's like, you know.
Yeah, of course. I don't go to, you know, I'm not sick every year either.
Okay. I just want to make that clear that's, you know, there are people that I haven't seen in 5 years, but if they get sick, they know where they're coming.
I totally get it. Speaking of which, what is the traffic through there? You saw 12 people the first day. What's the annual traffic of
So we see about 300 patients a day. Our dental clinic is actually the largest freestanding dental clinic in America. They do effectively 400 minor surgeries a week. And then the impact of fixing somebody's mouth. I mean, this is, you know, dentistry is an economic issue. Now, you can't go from a minimum wage job to a better job if your teeth are all messed up. It's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, so I see this guy who has a dental problem. He goes to the dentist. He can't afford the dentist. So he took measures into his own hands and he super glued his teeth together. What he didn't understand is that super glue will eat away all the enamel in your mouth. So by the time I saw him, his mouth was a total disaster. You know, this is America. When did it get to be that I'm working? I'm taking care of my family. You have dental pain, one of the worst pains you could have, and your only option is to super glue your mouth. We consider that to be immoral. This is something we should care deeply about. And by that, I mean the church and the faith community. But have you ever heard a sermon on dental care? I'm willing to bet you haven't. But in response to that, we built the largest freestanding dental clinic in America. And it's 100% focused on the working uninsured that gives people their smile back. It helps them get a better job. And it just completely changes their life.
Do you find that in the base of support for that 25 million, is some of that coming from churches, as in they give it the way they would give to missions? They're giving to you, not because you're a mission, you're not,
yes,
something else. So there's no confusion, but what sort of folks are supporting you? Because that's, you must have a very broad base of donation.
We do. And for example, the rabbi at Temple Israel, which is one of the largest Reformed congregations in America based here in Memphis, will tell you that Church Health is the most Jewish institution in Memphis. We also, we have Muslim doctors who both volunteer with us. They lead Juma prayers in our chapel on Friday afternoon. You know, we embrace this broad sense of the faith community. It's not about believing the way Scott believes, but it is about realizing there's a spiritual dimension to life that leads people to be healthier.
So when you get support?
So with churches, churches don't have a lot of money to give to an organization like ours.
Right.
But it is a good housekeeping seal of approval. We absolutely want to be in as many church budgets as we can be in, even if it's just for a couple of $100. We're not going to get $1 million gift from a church, but that person who does give us $1 million gift, the chances are great they first heard about us from their congregation. And that could be an evangelical church. It could be a mainline congregation. It could be Temple Israel, or it could be from our Muslim and Hindu friends. But so the point is, yes, we work as hard as we can to get into a church's budget, because people know to get $200 out of a church, you've had to climb Mount Everest. And so the vetting process is actually a strong thing. And that has served us well to be able to go through that process. But at the end of the day, that $25 million is mostly coming from individuals. And individuals support us year after year after year. So we don't necessarily have to go back and ask every year. Once people feel like this is something that is important in their lives, then they have a tendency to want to keep writing that check every year. But my view of this, you know, I talked about being healthy, having more joy, more love, and being driven closer to God. What I fully believe is that if somebody supports us, I mean, Frank, if you were to be able to follow through on that incredibly gracious offer to help tell our story, it should bring you more joy, more love, and drive you closer to God. If that doesn't happen, then don't do it. That's true in anybody's life, in your work. If you're not experiencing more joy, more love, and being driven closer to things, and it doesn't happen, then quit doing it. And we would say that to our donors as well. If supporting us doesn't bring that for you, then you pick the wrong organization to support.
Yeah, I have a question that Ernie, my producer, fired off into the chat section that I want to share with you. And that is, how scalable is this model? Could someone open a church health in another city, or is there something unique about Memphis? It's a good question. Yeah. And then I just want to say that I see you as a template that could be copied, I guess. I mean, no, there's not another Scott out there with your dynamic vision and fire. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because I think that people listening to this are going to be saying, there's going to be someone out there saying, hey, I live in Gary, Indiana. We could do this. Right. We're in an impoverished area. Why don't we have somebody like Scott doing this down the street from us?
Yeah. So the fact is, you do. Again, there are 1,400 clinics, 1,400 around America doing similar work.
Now, is it similar or related to you?
Well, so what's related to us, and the book talks about this, there are 90 clinics all over the country that we've helped spawn. And those clinics, if somebody in Gary, Indiana, if you're interested, you know, go to the Church Health website, which is churchhealth.org. Two or three times a year, we bring people to Memphis for a two-day course where we are going to show you how Church Health works. And then we don't franchise. You know, in Gary, Indiana, you cannot call it Church Health. If you cannot be creative enough to come up with your own name, you shouldn't be doing this. But, you know, opening a clinic in Gary, Indiana, it's not like opening a food pantry or a clothes closet.
Right.
You know, this is serious stuff. I mean, we deal with people's lives. So we have criteria as to what it takes to become an echo clinic. That's what we call it. So that you are going to be full time. You're not going to be using this for evangelism. You're going to be using this in order to do what God's called us to do. So yes, there are clinics like this all over the country. If you're in Gary, Indiana, or anywhere else, and you're interested in this, go to the Church Health website, churchhealth.org. You look around and you will see how we have what we call a replication seminar that you can come to. And during that 2 days, you can bring people. We will find out if you're serious about this. And if it turns out this is more than you want to do, we'll still be friends. Are absolutely people who want to do this work.
Have you found, as time gone by, I'm just so curious about the support you get. Now I'll talk about a different kind of support. You know, the media has not paid enough attention to what you're doing, obviously, because I never heard of it. And I read the New York Times, Washington Post, Guardian, and for balance, or I guess imbalance, the Daily Mail every day. I listen to BBC Radio 4 News. I do my best, you know, checking on MSNBC, NPR, all the rest. You know, I'm an informed person news-wise, and I'd never heard of what you're doing, which is insane. I mean, I know of all sorts of much smaller, crazy little things going on out there, and I don't know about what you do until today. So I'm actually, this is great, because I'm learning something huge. But I have a question. Do you have any kind of support from the political community? Are there governors in your state or congresspeople of either party who get this and who say, even though you're not hand out for government funding from them, who get what you're doing is important and speak well of you and say, hey, how can we help? Not by sending you money, but by telling people what these guys are doing is really important, or at least dropping by to say thank you.
So look, I've lived long enough to just watch all of this ebb and flow. You know, Steve Cohen, who is our congressman, could not be more supportive. Governors from time to time of Tennessee have been extremely supportive. But at the end of the day, no, if I never go to Washington again, I'm perfectly good with that. What we do is provide health care for the uninsured, right? During the Obama administration, after the creation of the Affordable Care Act, there were some problems that we had that I assumed that the Department of Health and Human Services would want to help us fix, right? This is a liberal administration, and we focus on caring for poor people, right? So, yes. So I go up there, plead my case with them, and then they ask me, has your state expanded Medicaid? And I'm go, no, that's exactly my problem. We are as deep a red state as you could have. We have not expanded Medicaid. You know, that's why I need your help. And what they said to me is, you go back and you get your state to expand Medicaid and then come back and talk to us and we'll try to help you.
Yeah.
You know, again, this is Jim Wallace's God's politics, how the right doesn't get it and the left doesn't care.
Yeah, because basically they just saw you as a bit of a pawn in a pushback against a red state to get them to do something they wanted them to do, not help you for the sake, for the intrinsic worth of what you were doing. You're just a step to some other right. part of their program.
That's right. Yeah. So it's been a while since I've been to Washington. I just find it the meanest place I've ever been. So
I'm glad you shared that, because that's an important counterbalance to this idea that, you know, somehow everything that comes out of a liberal or a left or a democratic thing is, you know, somehow healthy and good and balanced, because it's not the case. So I want to ask you something practical, and that is that in terms of helping you be heard so more people are aware of what you were doing, let's just think of that for a minute, because first of all, it's just an interesting story in and of itself, and end of story. It's just a fascinating thing that you've done this. I think one of the questions that media would hone in on, besides the funding, would be, and this angle of, well, are you proselytizing? Okay, you've answered that. Do you have a board? How does it function from that point of view? Because people are always interested in this structure behind the structure. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, we're a not-for-profit. I always emphasize we are a not-for-profit. People oftentimes talk about being nonprofits.
Right.
You know, what happens to a nonprofit? They go broke. So we are a not-for-profit, which just means at the end of the day, we have to have a black bottom line. But we have a small board. We only have 13 people on our board. You know, we are, you know, this is Memphis. My board is very tied to both FedEx and AutoZone with from a financial business standpoint. But we have clergy, we have doctors. You know, we everybody on our board is focused on how do we move our mission forward. That's how we determine who we're going to invite to be on our board. We have 3 year terms. You can serve 3 terms and then you have to roll off. You know, yeah. So that's our organizational structure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then in terms of you, you're the founder, but what's your official position these days? What do you call yourself on the board?
So I am a member of the board. I am my title these days. I didn't come up with this, but I'm the founder and CEO. That's my
excellent
title.
Yeah. And in that capacity, and you're also continuing your medical practice as part of the family practitioner angle there. I'm sure there are other family practice people who are with you and all these various disciplines. Is there inside the building there, is there any aspect of medicine that's not covered where you have to bring people in, or do you have OB people and you have yourself and you have,
So that's a good example. So, if you're poor and you're pregnant, that is the one way I know I can get you on Medicaid.
Right.
So you don't need us. We don't do that. You know,
sure.
What we will do is connect you to doctors who work with us, who we know will provide good care for that that future mother and that baby.
Sure.
You know, the biggest issue for us these days is our undocumented patients. You know, 50% of our patients these days speak Spanish, but it's not just Spanish. You know, one day my first 11 patients spoke 11 different languages. You know, this is Memphis. This is not New York.
Right.
So dealing with the issues of the undocumented is the thing I would lay down in the street over. I hope that doesn't happen. You know, you got to remember, I'm in Memphis and I'm, you know, 2 miles from where Martin Luther King was assassinated. You know, my own personal feeling is if King were alive today, the issue of immigration is the thing that he would be making front and center. You know, my own opinion about this is that, you know, if you've been in Memphis or in America and you're working and you're building houses and you fall off the roof and you break your leg, I think God will expect me to provide the best care possible to take care of you. But, you know, even with Bernie Sanders, Medicare for all did not mean Medicare for all. You know, if Medicare for all, nobody politically can go down that path of trying to figure out, you know, what happens when a person who's been in this country for 20 years gets sick. You know, how do we care for them? You know, Medicare for all's response to that would have been go back to Mexico. You know, I don't think that's what Jesus would have us do.
Yeah, talk a little more about the undocumented situation with your patients, but also just your views on immigration. You were saying you would lie down in the street for that. Expand on that a little bit in terms of how it impacts what you do and what you see, I think is a great point of departure. But then the subject more generally, how do you see that?
Well, look, people are, they focus on the southern border and people crossing every day. What people don't understand is that the average amount of time that an undocumented worker has been in America is 15 years, not 15 days, 15 years. And undocumented workers, I mean, Tennessee is a state that has no income tax. So undocumented workers, they pay sales tax through the nose. Most of them rent their apartments. They're paying tax that way. I mean, an undocumented worker pays as much tax in Tennessee as I do or anybody else. You know, how is it that they don't have any path to health care? I'm not saying a path to citizenship. I'm saying a path to health care, you know, but they don't.
Well, and how is it good for the country, even if our motivation was 100% utilitarian and selfish, to have a bunch of untreated, ill people either taken out of the workforce or sick within our society? It obviously doesn't make sense even from a utilitarian position. It's ridiculous.
I mean, back during Reagan, we had a guest worker program. You know, what happened to that? You know, this country needs workers.
Yes.
Who will do the job that other people are not willing to do.
And it's even more than that, because with the changes in demographics and the, you know, falling below replacement numbers in terms of the number of people having children and so forth, it's not even, you know, it's not a luxury anymore. It's an absolute necessity. So we're sort of counting on these folks and won't care for them.
Exactly. And again, where I come from this is totally from a religious perspective. You know, Jesus himself was, you know, undocumented at multiple times in his life, not the least of which when he goes to Egypt as a baby. You know, we see those children every day. And I just am as confident as I can be that I know what God expects of me in that situation. I don't have to take a stance over how we're supposed to deal with the southern border, you know, but once people are in my community, I know exactly what I'm supposed to do.
And I think we're going to leave it there. But Scott, let me just finish up by saying this is In Conversation with Frank Schaefer. Today, Dr. Reverend Scott Morris has been my guest, a family practitioner who runs what has to be one of the most astonishing and unexpected things in America, that 80,000 people depend on for healthcare, that is should be a model that would inspire a similar outreach to everybody. I know this is an odd way to finish it, but I think that you shame the rest of us into wondering where the hell have we been and what have we been thinking about. I know that I finished this interview really in a contemplative, way of thinking. I'm just deeply moved. And I'm going to stop for a minute and just wonder, you know, what I'm doing with my time and try to come up with a better answer. And I think one of the things I can do is really follow through on what I said, and that is make a project out of trying to let people know about what you're doing. This little podcast is sort of a beginning, but I'm really going to think about this. So if I get opportunities with media stuff in this next year, with some things that are being done about me to be there, I am going to talk to every single producer, every single interviewer, and just say, hey, forget this interview with me. Let me tell you about something you ought to be talking about. I really will direct attention to you to the ability that I can. And I would like to see a documentary crew put together to cover what you're doing and you. I mean, you have an incredible story. So I hope next time I look at those lovely glass repaired windows behind you, it's that I'm standing down there with some friends of mine who make movies and we're making a story about you, because that would be one way we could crack this wall of silence. So I can't thank you enough, Scott, for your life and for what you're doing and for the book. And the book is almost incidental. I mean, the story of what you're actually doing is really phenomenal. And I can't believe it, actually. I spend a lot of time talking about the failures of Christianity in this country and my own loss of faith because of it and so forth and so on. But I got to tell you, from now on, I have one example I'm going to be using and say, but on the other hand, I know this guy and he's actually doing the work. So thank you for giving me an example I can use.
Well, Frank, come to Memphis. We would love to show you around.
Be careful what you wish for. I'm going to show up.
Okay. The door's
all
open.
Right. All right. Thank you so much. Time. Okay. Right. Bye.
Bye.
In Conversation with Frank Schaefer is a production of the George Bailey Morality and Public Life Fellowship. It is produced by Ernie Gregg and hosted by Frank Schaefer, author of Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet, Be Happy, a post-pandemic blueprint for rebalancing work and family in favor of love and living. To learn more and support the show, please visit lovechildrenplanet.com.